All righty. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, a Thursday afternoon. Elise Glink will be here a little bit later. We'll talk about investments and what to do maybe at a younger age than an older, or how to get started, things like that. I want to begin the program, though, with Jill Gonzalez. She's an analyst at Wallet Hub, and they have done a study of credit scores around the country, sort of did it by city, and talk a little bit about that and as well about your own credit score and how to improve it. Jill, welcome back to the Business Lunch. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me back.
All right. So you looked at the numbers. What you did citywide, right? City by city. And I'm just wondering, does that tell you anything? Do credit numbers sort of mask the region that they're in, or reflect the region they're in, or is it just sort of a way for you to get into it?
Absolutely. There's a lot of things that we can tell from credit scores. Usually, an older population tends to have a better credit score, more in savings, keeping up with bills, et cetera, higher incomes. Younger towns, college towns especially, tend to have worse off credit scores. So you can definitely tell a few different things for a city by its credit score.
If you're a leader, a political leader or whichever kind, I mean, I'm just wondering, does this inform policy at all, or it just sort of speaks to the character of the town?
I would say it informs business more than policy, right? So if you are sure that you want to bring a franchise or something to Southeast Florida, but you're not sure exactly what city, you know, if putting it in an area where there might be higher credit scores, people might have a need for this type of thing, depending on the business, that could certainly tell you what location to be looking at. And a lot of times in business, you know, this is really a metric to be targeting, advertising, et cetera. So really informing marketing issues as well.
All right, let me ask you a really uninformed question, maybe a stupid question. Does credit score reflect income or poverty? Because my first thought was that it wouldn't, because if you don't have the money to spend, you're not spending money. But, of course, it's just the opposite's probably true. If you don't have the money to spend, you're taking extending credit and having a bad credit score. Does income have to do with credit scores?
It does, indirectly, as you said, and it's definitely more of the latter. So your income is not actually used when making your credit score, right? That has a lot more to do with your payment history, so keeping up with bills, which might be easier if your income level is higher. It also has a lot to do with credit utilization. So typically, we like to see people using around 30% of their total credit lines. 30 to 50% is more average, I would say. And then
what does that mean, Jill? What does that mean?
That means that you're using, say that you have $1,000, that's your credit line.
Right.
You should be using anywhere from $300 to $500 of that on a monthly basis after you're paying that off. So that should be the balance that when credit companies update your score and update their report every month, you know, that's the information that's really trickling down into your credit score.
So that they're seeing that you're using the credit that you've been extended but still paying it off?
Correct.
Okay. And if I'm not, if I'm only using $50 of that $1,000, does that reflect badly?
No, that would reflect nicely, actually.
Okay. So, but if I'm spending $999, that might reflect badly.
Exactly. Maxing out your cards would not be good for your score.
Okay. You're going to have to talk slowly to me today, I'm afraid. How did Chicago do in this study?
Chicago, and I will say that most big cities did not do too well here. We looked at almost 2,600 cities across the country. Chicago ranked at number 2011.
Ooh.
So toward the bottom. And if we're talking about percentiles, you know, 99th percentile would be great. Actually, Naperville is up there.
Yeah, I saw that.
But Chicago is more like the 21st percentile. So the average credit score in Chicago right now is about 648. That's fair credit.
And how does it compare to other big cities?
A lot of cities that are that big are in that area, but there are some large ones that definitely did a lot better. San Francisco, for instance, is seeing credit scores of about 50 to 60 points higher on average. Honolulu, Seattle, San Jose, all very high here.
Interesting. I guess towns you might pick. So I'm looking at the list, and Bennett Wakenight has cherry-picked some of the Illinois cities out. It looks like Wilmette had the best score at 744. followed then by Lake Forest and Northbrook. You don't know, Jill, but those three towns are almost adjacent to each other at 7:39, and then Naperville, as you said, at 7:23.
Yeah, and we do see that, too. You know, Chicago certainly has its pocket of suburbs that are doing a little bit better here credit-wise, and a lot of this has to do with lower debt-to-income ratios, too.
All right, so if you want to improve your credit score, one of the things I've heard is that you should not pay off your entire credit card bill to show that you're good for paying it later. Is that a good idea or a bad idea?
That's a bad idea. I would say, you know, pay off your bills, you know, as quickly as you can. I would say, you know, pay your rent for the month, and after that, after you get your paycheck, really make sure that you're paying your bills on time. And if you can pay more than the minimum, do so. I think what you might be referring to is not closing your credit cards. A lot of people think, you know what, I'm done with this card. I don't want to use it anymore. Let me close the account. That's actually going to ding your credit score because length of history is one of the key components to the score. So
you're better off having a few long, unused, open credit cards than you are a few very often used credit cards.
Correct.
Wow, I didn't know that. One other thing, we got to run, but tell me a little bit about the credit report, because often there are mistakes there, right? How often do people have a mistake on their own credit report?
1 in 5 credit reports have an error, and that's one of the quickest ways you can improve your score. I mean, it's very common for these things to happen. You can dispute that, get it taken care of, and watch your score almost overnight improve by 40, 50, 60 points.
Jill Gonzalez, an analyst at Wallet Hub. You offer credit scores, right?
We do. We offer credit scores, full credit reports from TransUnion, which is actually located in Chicago, all for free.
All right. Check that out, wallethub.com. Jill, great to talk to you again. I appreciate it.
Anytime. Thanks.
It's 12:23. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Shelley Young is in the studio, the chef, the owner behind the Chopping Block. They're celebrating their 20th anniversary coming up next month. Bring that microphone a little bit closer to you, Shelley. Welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Steve.
I'm a little disappointed you didn't bring in any materials.
I know. I didn't bring in anything, no.
So tell me about the Chopping Block. What is it? Because it seems like it's a lot of things.
Well, you know, I think what we're known for is our recreational cooking classes. I also think probably is the biggest part of our business is our private cooking events. And then we sell cookware, ingredients, and, you know, spirits and wine.
I think you're probably one of those places, and you tell me if you hear this a lot, where people say, I've been meaning to go there. I really have wanted to go. Right?
I know. I hear a lot probably more I went there which is probably a good sign. And maybe why we've been in business for 20 years.
And so I love the slogan, get people to cook.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that people are cooking more now than they did when you started 20 years ago. Am I right about that?
You know, it's hard for me to judge. I think that they're certainly more knowledgeable about food now than they were 20 years ago. There's so much food information out there now, and so people come in very informed.
When did you know that you had something that this was going to work?
Well, really, before we even opened the doors.
Really?
Because I put, imagine, this was 20 years ago, so times are a bit different, so I put an ad, you know, my phone book, in the phone book. Put my listing in there, and the minute we got the phones, and it was several months before we opened, the phone started ringing. And so I was writing down their numbers the old school way.
Isn't that a great feeling?
I know, calling them back and saying, hey, we're open, and come on in. And
so you started at Clyburn and Webster area,
mm-hmm,
right?
Yeah.
Expanded down to the Merchandise Mart and also Lincoln Square.
The second location was Lincoln Square. And then we moved the original location to the Mart.
Do people come to you because they want to... Well, I guess the events, the parties are one thing, but if it's a private cooking class, mm-hmm, do people want to cook better for their family? They want to cook better for themselves, or want something to do?
You know, there's all of those things. I think when we started originally, we attracted more people that were very much interested in learning how to cook, either for their health, for their family,
right,
for themselves, you know, any of those things. And now we have a huge part of our business is I'm taking my friend out. I'm going on a date.
Yeah, it's a social event. It's a fun thing.
Yeah.
But cooking is such a loving thing to do. And
well, at least people that like to cook think that. There are people that don't like to cook. Don't
that's
think
right. So that's
but they
why,
come and drink wine, and
well,
they have a good time too.
I guess that speaks to the fact how I can't understand why people don't like to cook, because I just think it's such a sort of nurturing, wonderful. What do you make of Plated and all of those sorts of businesses that are sending ingredients home now and having people cook them?
Yeah, our mission is to get the country cooking. So if that's what it takes to for somebody to do it, I think it's great. You know, I think whatever it takes, competition, anything that gets people cooking is great. And then people evolve or they don't. Some people really don't enjoy cooking. And some people think that they don't cook, but
they
actually
do. Right?
Do. If you cook at all, you cook.
I think if you can paint by numbers, you can cook in many ways, right? I mean, you can to a degree.
I think, yeah, there are people who are more
the
recipe.
The expert's rolling my eyes. I mean, yeah. I'm totally a recipe guy.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm saying some people are recipe cooks, and some of our chefs might be more inclined to want to teach people to cook without recipes. I think that's futile. I think if you like to cook with recipes, who cares?
Right,
cook with
right.
recipes. If you don't, don't. But, you know, I think some people just really don't enjoy the process, and but they still do need to generally cook sometimes. And so if we can help them out and make it a little more pleasurable, give them a couple recipes that they can keep up their sleeves.
And a glass of red.
That makes it a lot easier for most people. And
Shelley Young is the owner of The Chopping Block. Okay, so the big anniversary is next month. The events that people can take advantage of?
Yeah, well, we're actually having two free events.
Oh, nice.
So if you've never experienced a chopping block, you'll be able to do that on April 1st at our Lincoln Square location and April 8th at our Merchandise Mart location during the day, like 10 to 5. We'd have open house classes, wines, all kinds of things going on just to get a taste of what we are and to thank our customers who have been keeping us in
business.
That sounds
great. Okay, so now how do I keep my knives sharp?
Well, we have a most popular class from the day we opened till today
is
still knife skills.
I don't doubt it.
Uh-huh. And so we'll teach you how to do that. You can pop in the store. It's easier to just show you personally how to do that because the angle is really the trick. But let me give you a visual since we're on radio.
Yeah, do it.
Now, I used to say this all the time. Take a matchbook and put it up against your sharpening steel. But now sometimes people don't know what matchbooks are anymore.
Right.
So, again, 20 years of business, things change. But that's about the angle, 10 to 15 degrees of your knife angle that it should hit any sharpening stone. And that's one of the big tricks.
Well, I have something to do tonight. Thanks for that.
There you go.
Shelley Young, thanks very much for coming by.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch. So now the only question is to figure out which team Jay Cutler will go to and bring to the playoffs next year. That's probably about how it will work. So Jay Cutler's days with the Bears apparently over. Ian Scher's days with CNET, well, they've only just begun. Ian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
How are you doing?
Good.
I'm not a free agent, by the way.
I have a Vizio TV. Is the CIA watching me?
You know, that is the question of the day. I mean, it's like, it's crazy that 1984 got this stuff so correct so long ago. So the latest that we've heard is that the WikiLeaks came out with this huge data dump a couple of days ago, and they said that the CIA, among other things, other than being able to hack into our phones and our computers when we thought they couldn't, was that they can hack into our television.
Wasn't it cute when they could just...
That we can voice control.
Wasn't it cute when they can just sort of steam open our envelopes back in the day? Oh, I miss those days. So Julian Assange
those were the days.
Assange had a news conference today and talked about this. And in fact, he said that now he wants to share what he knows with Samsung and others.
We have decided work with them to give them some exclusive access to the additional technical details we have so that fixes can be developed and pushed out so people can be secured.
So what do you do if you're an executive? Do you go work with public enemy number one in order to make things more secure? I guess you would.
I mean, look, the thing is that Apple and Google trade themselves on the fact that they are secure, right? They have taken a position of, we will protect you against governments and we will protect your information, and we value that. And especially Apple, in the last couple of years, they have really gone hard on this position. And so they, you know, I don't know whether or not they're going to work with WikiLeaks, but it's a safe bet that if WikiLeaks comes to their door and says, hey, here's the security vulnerability you didn't know about that's being used by the government, they're going to take it and try and fix it.
So we should see if Tim Cook is going to visit Ecuador and maybe the embassies of Ecuador around the world.
You know, it's going to be interesting. It brings these companies into a very weird position, because in some ways now the tech industry is being positioned as this last place to go before the government's able to stare into our lives. And that's a really weird thing. And it's really weird that these devices that used to be just the things that we, send messages one another, and I send my baby photos to my in-laws, is now becoming this question of, is someone staring back through the screen? That's really weird.
Right. And so I don't know if I got a little ahead of myself, but the WikiLeaks report said that the CIA was using Samsung TVs, or could sort of enable, like when you're talking to a smart TV, telling them to turn the channel, there's a microphone there. And the CIA has an ability to turn that on and monitor what you might be saying in a room. Apparently, that's according to WikiLeaks. Samsung, from what I was reading, maybe it was on CNET, that Samsung's not even sure that can happen. Right, Ian?
Right. Yeah. And that's the thing. They put out a statement that we wrote about. And this is the thing, right? This is, by the way, this is very similar to what happened when the Edward Snowden leaks happened a few years ago, is that the tech industry kind of looked at this and was like, that doesn't make sense. And it turned out that a lot of that stuff, as it played out, a lot of that stuff actually did make sense, but it was in a very weird way. And the odds are that what these documents say, if they are legitimate, and by the way, no one has been able to authenticate them, but the CIA has said that they hurt our national security. So it's a guess that they're probably right, on the whole accurate. If this stuff is true, then yeah, the television can listen to you if it has a microphone. But remember also, the government has laws that says that the CIA can't spy on American citizens. So there is a hope, at least, that this stuff isn't being used on us, but it's being used on your grandparents in another country.
Well, if the CIA is working on my TV, I hope they will improve the remote, because I can't get my smart remote to ever work.
That's the other thing, right?
Well, let me ask you, is that common? I cannot get my smart remote, with the mouse on the screen. It's always going in and out. Is that a common problem with the technology, or is it really just my mouse?
Well, I mean, it could be just you, but the reality is that a lot of the tech out there, especially when it comes to televisions, has always been a little fraught with not always working perfectly as they described, but also voice commands and everything, as we have learned with Siri and everything else, they're just not perfect yet.
Right,
and so the experiences that you and I have are not ideal. And there is a massive undertaking in Silicon Valley to make that stuff better. But now here's the question, right? Part of what makes those things better is us using them, and them having data about how we use them to learn how to make them better. If we all become fearful of these things, then they can't make it better, and all the system kind of starts falling apart. So
and how are they
really interesting to see how normal people respond.
Right, and how are they getting the data? They're getting the data from the TVs that we're using. Speaking of all that, you mentioned Apple earlier and their secrecy. There's a story. It involves actually Chicago attorney Kathleen Zellner, and it's out of Arkansas, I think, where a guy is facing murder charges. And there were subpoenas to get Amazon to turn over the records that he had used with Echo or Alexa. And they eventually agreed to do it, right? I mean, that seems to me to be a big switch for the technology companies.
Huge switch. And especially when Apple fought the FBI so dramatically last year, went on national television and everything, not to get into a terrorist's phone, because they said doing that would make all of our phones less secure. Amazon did this. Now, the important distinction is this murder trial, they believe that the recordings that Alexa has, and every time you talk to Alexa, it keeps a recording, that those could have information about a murder trial and a murder case inside of them. But the person who owns the Alexa, the person on trial, actually allowed Amazon to give them. So Amazon didn't have to fight this fight. And we don't know how it would have gone. They didn't end up having to fight it in court. He just said, look, I'm innocent. I want them to have the recordings. It's not going to show anything.
And
so that's why it would kind of ended in a weird way.
And so which is a similar way to how the iPhone fight ended, right? So we really haven't had a big test in court yet on this issue.
No, we haven't. I mean, the iPhone one was different, where the government actually hacked into the phone. They found a way to do it without Apple's help. But yes, this really raises, we still don't know the answer to these overriding questions about, can the tech industry have their arms twisted to such a degree that they give up this information that in their terms of service they promise is ours?
That's Ian Schur. You can read a lot more about all of that at CNET.com. Ian, great to talk to you again.
My pleasure.
All right. Thank you, Steve Alexander, Kim Gordon, and Jill Egan as well. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. And Elise Glink is on a phone line. Elise, we were talking about the birthday, the eighth birthday of the bull. I asked Alexander, you'd think he would know, but what do you buy an eight-year-old bull market?
Well, I was going to say, it's also my husband Sam's birthday today.
Oh, happy birthday, Sam.
And so we have marveled over the years at the highs and lows of the market and how they correspond directly with where his birthday is. So, for example, there are other highs of the market that have hit on March 9th as well. So 8 years ago, we had the low. But if you go all the way back to, I think it's 1999, I want to say, March 9th is when we hit another high.
No kidding.
In the stock market. Yep.
Well, so that could be a bad sign, because if his birthday is the high, that means that we're about to go down.
It could be. It could be, although there have been a couple of years in between where that wasn't the case. But I always wonder on March 9th whether I should be buying or selling.
Well, what should we be doing? I mean, let's look at this. I guess we could look at it from different age groups. But if you are, in your 50s and you're looking at this high market, it might be very different from when you're in your 20s or 30s.
Well, so the thing that I think people in their 20s and 30s and even 40s should think about, it's very hard when you get to a place in the market is where it is. It will go down at some point in time. I don't know what day. I don't know if it'll be today is the last day. Who knows? But stock markets have a long run in them. And when you're in your 20s and you're not going to touch the money until you're in your 70s, 80s, or 90s, you know, that's the time to take as much risk as you possibly can. And so for people who are in their 20s, 30s, and 40s who ask me how they should balance their accounts, I say, you know, you really should be extremely heavy in a diversified portfolio of stocks and usually index mutual funds, right? Because they're cheap to own, you get great diversification. And when you even hit your 50s and 60s, you still want to think about a very heavy load and 70s because you could have 20, 30, or even 40 more years where you're going to need those kinds of stock market returns. So I'm very pro general stock market.
Okay, but even if you're risky in the stock market, you're still advising a fund approach, not an individual stock approach.
Right, because I decided a long time ago that it's really hard to understand individual companies anymore, and gap accounting means well, but we're going into an era where I think the individual investor is not the top priority anymore. So if that's the case and you're not the top priority, and we've already heard the current administration talk about how they want to roll back the fiduciary rules, you know, that to me says the individual investor, you and me individually, nobody's watching out for us so much. So by using an index mutual fund or another mutual fund that's inexpensive to own, what that gets you is complete diversification for very, very low cost. So as the market goes, so goes your portfolio.
All right. So if you're 25, 30 years old, 35 years old, and you've got money, a cushion to invest, I mean, the other thing people always say is go hard at your 401k. Should you go all in with your 401k, or do you hedge your bet a little bit, invest with the idea that, well, I might need some of this when I'm 50 or 55. I don't want to tie it all up in my 401k, even though the tax benefits might be better there.
Oh, you can hardly do better than a 401k. So you have a 401k, and let's assume it offers you some sort of index mutual funds. Maybe they're the cheapest, maybe they're not the cheapest, but most of the big financial fund companies now, Fidelity, Vanguard, Charles Schwab, they all offer extremely inexpensive index funds. You can hardly do better. Your employer is often matching that money, so that's free money right off the bat.
Okay.
And now you're going to plug it in off the top, so you're not even going to miss that money. It's not like you have to come up with it at the end of the month. Before you even see it, before it hits your taxes, it's going to get socked away. So max out your 401k, and then we can talk about Roth IRAs.
Tell me about Roth IRAs.
This is after-tax money, and some companies actually have Roth IRAs, internal Roth 401ks, they call them, but they're internal to it. But it allows you to put away money above and beyond that's tax-free, grows tax-free forever. And then you have some other special benefits with a Roth IRA where you can pass them down to generations. after 5 years, you can take out contributions, all kinds of really nice things. So those two things together, and you can start to really sock away some serious bucks.
All right, Elise Klink, happy birthday to Sam.
Thank you. I'll pass that along. Have a good one.
We'll talk to you again soon. That is Elise Klink. You can follow Elise at thinklink.com. She's the CEO of Best Money Moves, an HR app for businesses that helps employees measure their financial stress and then dial it down a bit. Find out more at thinklink.com.